This is the Andy Pollin Hour. On Washington's new home for sports, ESPN 630, the sports capital.
Tony's coming up at 11 o'clock. We'll talk to Bram Weinstein at 10:20 as we go through more of yesterday's game and the loss that looked like a blowout loss and then suddenly got very, very interesting there in the fourth quarter. Unfortunately, there was a turnover late and Dallas was able to close out the game. But, for a while there was maybe a possibility that Mike McCarthy was going to have to eat some crow. And Mike McCarthy did something last week that some of us thought was a big mistake. Ron Rivera said it was a big mistake. He went out and said that he expected his team to win the game. And in the first half, he was very much delivering on his promise. But then, after Cole Holcomb made that play with the pick six to put Washington back in it, it looked for a while like maybe this is going to be very, very interesting. And maybe Mike McCarthy isn't going to be able to say after the game what he said. Now, if I'm McCarthy, I take it the Jimmy Johnson way. I get in front of the media and I go, well, what did I tell you guys? I told you we're going to win the game. We won the game. What was all this criticism about? I told you we were going to win it. But Mike McCarthy is sort of a plotting guy. You know, he's not very flamboyant. When he was questioned about the guarantee last week, he said, what am I supposed to say? Come on, use better grammar than that. Supposed to say. So this is all he could muster up to beat his chest with the media.
You know, from our perspective, it's obviously win the game. These division games, it's December football, but we need to improve in some areas, and I think we did that. But you know, obviously, we have work to do, and I think it's just a kind of a product of, you know, everything that you know, all teams go through. You look what Washington's going through with the challenges and the COVID and you know those types of stuff. So, I was obviously very pleased to come in here and get this division win.
Yeah. Okay. So. You know, kind of a mundane statement. Jerry Jones, I haven't heard from him yet. Maybe he beat his chest a little bit. Our coach said that they would win the game, and we went out and we delivered our heated benches from, I think they came in from Cleveland. I don't know what the Cowboys benches were doing sitting in Cleveland, but they delivered those. And we took care of business, and now we're in the driver's seat for the division. I'll get to the division races in just a moment. Here's the play, though, and this is where I have my hand on the remote. About to go to the Red Zone channel. This game is over, I'm sure. Many people abandoned the game at this point of the 61,000 that showed up at FedEx Field wearing burgundy and gold. I don't know how many had left at this point, but this is in the fourth quarter, and it's a 27-14 game, and then this happens.
Dak is under center. He's going to do play action, roll to the right. Wise closes it on. Picked off by Cole Holcomb at the 30. 25-20, 15-10, 5 on his feet. Pick 6, touchdown.
Yes.
Touchdown, Washington.
Yeah, so now we got a game. Now, of course, the extra point is blocked, and they have to be on pace. I got to find out what the record is. They have to be on pace for the most blocked kicks this year. I mean, they had a kicker here named Blewett who attempted 5 field goals, and 3 of them were blocked. They've had other extra points blocked this season. I mean, it just shouldn't happen. This is the NFL. This is, you don't get extra points blocked. And they had another one blocked yesterday. But, still they had a chance to tie or win the game by going for 2 on that last possession before there was a turnover. And here's Holcomb yesterday talking about the pick 6, which was the first of his career.
As soon as I caught it, I was like, gotta take it to the crib. Wanted to throw it in the stands. I had to deal with my college coach that I would, but it was my first one ever, so I had to keep it. I don't know. I was like, I didn't know what to, I like didn't know what to do. I was super stoked. I was excited. I had a bunch of emotions running through, and then it's like, you got to go back out there. We got to get another stop. So I was like trying to collect myself again, almost like, it was a good feeling.
No, you don't throw the ball in the stands because then you have to do what the Buccaneers had to do, where you had to retrieve Tom Brady's ball and you had to pay off the fan. Just hold the ball. Emmett Smith had it right. of his touchdowns, I think he's got like 140 of them or something like that. He's got he may have the record for the most career rushing touchdowns. Anyway, he always saved them. You'd see this if you watch NFL films where they've done Emmitt Smith documentaries. He throws the ball over to one of the assistants there, when somebody on the equipment staff, and they save the ball for him and they paint him all up. You know, don't throw it in the stands. You know, hang on to the ball. So he did that, and yes, they had an opportunity, and they did get a stop. That was important. You know, after the emotion of that, they got a stop, and Washington had a chance to tie or win the game. And if this catch is made, I think maybe we're talking about a different story this morning.
Allen in the gun, second and three. Snap to Kyle. He's going to throw a deep fade towards DeAndre Carter. Did he pull that in? No! Oh. Near catch at the 25-yard line.
Yeah, it was a perfect throw. It was right there. He threw it exactly where he should have thrown it. That's Kyle Allen, who was in the game at this point. And Carter dropped it. If he makes that catch, you know, maybe on the next play, Kyle Allen isn't pressing so much. Maybe he's not trying to make something happen as much as he did. And there isn't that turnover. And they find a way to get the ball in the end zone because the momentum is there. You know, the Cowboys had stopped playing at that point. They were playing the fourth quarter. I don't know what they were doing. But they didn't look like they were that interested in still being there. They thought they should have been on the plane back to Dallas at that point. And Washington was still playing. So the momentum was there. And if he makes that catch, I think that fires them up tremendously. And maybe they get it in the end zone. Doesn't happen. So they're now 6-7. And at 6-7, they are in a mix. Here are the teams this morning that are also 6-7. Philadelphia, which had a bye last week, so Washington goes there next week. They have the opportunity. It's all in front of them. Two games against Philadelphia over the next 3 weeks. Then you have Atlanta and New Orleans, both at 6-7. They've beaten both of those teams, so they get a tiebreaker there. And then Minnesota is 6-7. So I don't know how the tiebreakers pan out there, but they haven't shown any real consistency this year. So who knows what's going to happen? It's possible both teams could make it, as a matter of fact. As far as the divisions go, Dallas has pretty much clinched the East at 9-4. Tampa Bay has got the South wrapped up at 10-3. Green Bay winning last night, so they're 10-3 in the North Division. And if Arizona beats the Rams tonight, that'll pretty much eliminate L.A. The Rams are 8-4, and Arizona is 10-2, and they're still in the driver's seat for the bye. Only one team in each conference gets a bye. And then still, you know, other possibilities. San Francisco is 7-6. And I don't think you count out Carolina completely at 5-8, but Washington has beaten them. Giants are done. Detroit is obviously done. Chicago losing last night, they're probably done. And Seattle's playing better now. You know, Washington got them at the right time. Seattle 5-8. I don't know if you count them out either. But as Ron Rivera says, everything is still in front of them.
We have an opportunity to do something. We got four games left, all four in the division. You know, some interesting things can happen. You know, somebody else can lose a game or two as well. And who knows? And I told our players that, you know, that we control it. We take them one at a time. We got Philly coming up. We know that. You know, I told the guys we'll get through this tomorrow, and then we'll start focusing on getting ready for Philadelphia. You know, it's one of those things, too, that, like I said, the Washington football team versus Dallas should be a big game like it was today. We just got to play better.
Yeah, well, they got to play better with backups because, and I'll get to what happened on the defensive line, but they're really down now. I mean, they've been doing an amazing job with next man up, but sooner or later you run out of next men. Sooner or later you're getting guys who are, you know, barely NFL quality. They bounce from practice squad to practice squad. Every once in a while you find a guy who gets an opportunity and takes advantage of it and runs with it. But, you know, they're not playing for a reason. And so let me get to the good and the bad from yesterday. I'll run through each of them. The good list is obviously very short. The good is this wasn't a 38-3 kind of game, and it was trending in that direction for a while there in the first half, that they did make it exciting in the fourth quarter. The defense did a good job. I mean, they held Dallas 7 of 18 on third downs. Compared to where they were in the first half of the season, that's a good job. And they picked off Dak Prescott twice, once for a pick six. And the Cowboys were able to control possession of the ball. They had it for an extra 10 minutes, but they only got 323 yards of offense. That's not too bad, considering what happened with Washington with their own turnovers and their own mistakes. The bad, it's lengthy, obviously. Taylor Heinicke in the first half was horrid. 2 for 12 for 19 yards. The team had just 29 yards in the entire first half. For the game, he was 11 of 25, 44%. He threw for 122 yards and a touchdown, one interception, and one fumble. And what were his numbers? His numbers were his quarterback rating was not very good. It was whatever it was. It was 55.8. It's bad. He was not good. It's probably the worst start of his career. And the question is, what happens next week? Now, I did talk to Trevor Maddich in the last hour. He thinks Heinicke, it's his job. They're not going to mess with him the rest of the way. They're going to tell him he's the guy. He's not going to be looking over his shoulder at Kyle Allen, who played pretty well yesterday when he got the opportunity. He's going to be the guy the rest of the way. The question is health. Now, Heinicke said that his knee is fine, and he didn't go to a press conference yesterday. He talked to reporters on the phone, but he said his knee is going to be fine. But he mentioned something about the elbow, and you may have seen his elbow being worked on the sidelines. He came back in the game, but when he missed the play early on, this was might have been the first half, when Kyle Allen came in and his one play, he ran for that first down, which I thought was kind of interesting. Like, hey, you guys think I'm so slow and Heinicke is such a fast guy. Well, watch this. And he got 10 yards and a first down. And then Heinicke, as you do when you had to wait all that time for your opportunity, you don't let anybody else have it. You get back on the field as soon as you can. And he did. But his elbow might be a problem. And Rivera is going to have a news conference today, as he does every Monday. And he's very careful about not giving injury updates. What he does is he talks to the media before he talks to the trainer on purpose. He'll tell you that because he doesn't want to talk too much about injuries. And then he's got all of Tuesday where he doesn't talk at all. And then you have to wait till Wednesday to find out what's going on. So I don't think it's 100% that he starts next week. But Rivera did say that if Heinicke is healthy, he will be the starter against Philadelphia. Also on the bad list, the depth. And this is where not only is it bad for Montez Sweat to wind up on the COVID list, and he reportedly is not vaccinated, he's in the room with the other defensive ends. So 24 hours before the game, they find out that the fourth string or third string, whatever you want to call them, the other guys who are supposed to play defensive end, Casey Tuhill and James Smith-Williams, they're both out. So now you're down to guys who are practice squad, on the 53, but inactive some games. And, you know, that's a problem. So it's double-edged for Sweat. Not only is he out of the game, but he's putting other people out of the game. Or it appears that way anyway. I can't say for 100% that that's the reason that they were on the COVID list. But, you know, you put two and two together, it does look like four. Offensive line, they're already down to their, well, Tyler Larson was the backup center. He had come back from injury. Looks like he's got a torn Achilles, so his season is probably over. Wes Schweitzer, who is like the third string center, he was inactive yesterday. No word on whether he's going to be able to go next week. So Keith Ishmael played center. As a matter of fact, I think Schweitzer's on injured reserve, so he's not even eligible to come back and play against Philadelphia. They're going to have to pick up another center off the street, and Keith Ishmael, who hasn't been terrible, but, you know, you saw what Micah Parsons was able to do. You pretty much run through the middle like a hot knife through butter. What are they going to do next week against Philadelphia? They'll have to make some adjustments there. Terry McLaurin being on the concussion protocol, that's a big deal. That's a real big deal because they need him to win, not just for what he does on the field, but for what he does off the field. I think he's the heart and soul of the team. I really do. You might say it's Heinicke. You might say it's Jonathan Allen. But I think what he does week in and week out, and the way he got hurt, I mean, he was trying to make a play. He went up. He had Trayvon Diggs in his pants all day long, and he went up and tried to make a catch, and he couldn't come down clean with it and hit his head on the turf, as you saw, and they took him off the field. Curtis Samuel didn't make a catch yesterday, so your two top receivers, no catches, and you don't want to have a game where Adam Humphries and Sims are your two top receivers, Cam Sims with a total of seven catches between them. That's not a good formula for victory. The run game, which has been their bread and butter in that four-game win streak, that didn't happen. In the first half, they had 12 carries for 36 yards, and they faced third downs of Third and 13, third and 10, third and 7, third and 8, third and 6, and third and 15, they went 0-6. 0-for-6 on third downs. That was a huge difference there. And Antonio Gibson, who I was ready to say, well, maybe he's figured out the fumbling. Nope, he fumbled. He fumbled in the game and wound up on the bench. You know, James Williams scored a touchdown for them. That's a guy, another guy, right off the practice squad, because Gibson, they don't say he was benched, but it looks like he was benched. He had, again, 10 carries, 36 yards, and a fumble. Not good. They had no answer for Micah Parsons, who put on a Lawrence Taylor-like performance yesterday. Two sacks and a forced fumble. They also had Randy Gregory healthy again. That made a huge difference. Parsons is 6'3". He's 245 pounds. And the reason he wasn't on more of everybody's radar last year, because he opted out of the season for Penn State for COVID. He had the opportunity to play, decided not to play last season. And he looks like he's going to be a monster to deal with. 6'3", 245, and he is all over the field. They list him as a defensive end, but he's just a pass rushing force. He is somebody that they're really going to have to be concerned about. Block point after attempt. I don't think it's time to bring in a fifth kicker. Joey Sly's on injured reserve, so he's got to sit out another game. But that's troubling. I mean, you can't have this. I mean, it just is a disaster this year in the kicking game. Didn't cost them the game, but didn't help. And seemed to take some of the air out of them after the pick six that they had. Also, penalties. This surprised me. Each team only had 7 penalties. I thought each team had like 15 of them. There were 3 offsides for Washington, and William Jackson had his 5th pass interference of the season. That ties him for the most in the NFL. Penalties were just killers yesterday, and even though each team had 7 of them, it seemed like they were just worse for Washington. Those offsides, come on, move on the movement of the ball. You know, this is not some sage quarterback who knows how to draw teams offsides. Dak Prescott is still relatively new in this league. And they were awful on that. So penalties hurt them, a lot of other things, and it was just it was a bad time to have a bad game. And the fact that it was a 7-point game really doesn't tell the whole story of the way Washington played yesterday. Get more on this with Bram Weinstein, who called the game here on ESPN 630 yesterday. We'll talk to Bram coming up next. It's the Andy Pollin Hour, ESPN 630. Yes, indeed. The boys were back in town yesterday, and they brought a bunch of their fans with them. And at least that's the way it sounded on television. Bram Weinstein called the game here on ESPN 630 yesterday, and that's a good place to start. They announced 61,000. Of that 61,000, from what you could tell, what was the percentage you thought of Dallas fans?
Like 30-40%.
Yeah, at least.
There was a lot. Yeah, there was a lot.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. I mean, like, that's not unusual. I mean, like, you know, honestly, what I'm finding actually, too, Andy, it's interesting. It's obviously this game draws a lot of Cowboys fans, just in general through the years. You'll see a lot of Eagles fans at that last home game as well. Mm-hmm. But I mean, last week in Vegas, there was probably 20,000-30,000 Washington fans. We're seeing this everywhere we go, where there's a lot of traveling done by, you know, traditional franchises. And I don't know, maybe it's kind of a new thing, you know, where people are spending their money on a trip as opposed to necessarily paying for the home ticket.
Yeah,
I don't know really what to make of it, but it's happening all over the place, really.
Yeah, that's part of it. And, of course, you know, the Dallas thing has always been kind of bizarre. You have to explain this to out-of-town people, that your biggest rival is also a team that has a huge fan base here. It always has.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know. I don't know where you attribute it to, because it's been like this forever.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of people that rebelled against their fathers who decided to go against them and,
yeah,
and just go with the opposite thing. And then, you know, really back in the day, and I know, like, I think probably a younger generation doesn't realize how popular they were, how profiled they were, how being in the 4 o'clock window every week was actually a big deal at the time when Summerall and Madden were calling their games every single week.
Mm-hmm.
They were the Lakers of the NFL. I mean, they were just the Yankees, the Lakers, the Cowboys, you know, like they were the popular team. And so, you know, I'm not surprised America's team has America's fan base.
Yeah,
SoFi Stadium opened this year, you know, for the first time with fans in Los Angeles for the Chargers. Great. It's not the Rams, it's the Chargers, but that's their home stadium. Go take a look at what that crowd looked like in, like, week 1 when they played, or week 2, whatever it was, when they played the Cowboys, where it was just littered with Cowboys fans in Los Angeles. It was really amazing.
Oh, yeah. Well, look, I mean, even when you had both the Rams and the Raiders there, those games were blacked out because they didn't sell out. So they were seeing the Cowboys instead of the home team. So that had something to do with it. Also, too, if you want to go way back, it's because, you know, partly because Washington was all white when the Cowboys came in. They had black stars. They became good right away. You know, a lot of things add up to it. But anyway, that's only part of what happened yesterday. The other part of what happened is we had a game that was essentially over, and it looked like the Cowboys were kind of disinterested in still being there. And then Cole Holcomb has a pick six, and all of a sudden we got a game. What was the feeling in the stadium at that point?
I could, when they got the ball back before the Allen fumble, I almost could not believe that we were in a one-score game. It never really felt, you know, like that it was going to get close, but I think you hit the nail on the head. It was about late in the third quarter, and there were two things that happened that really stood out to me that I actually think are positives for Ron Rivera to lean on as he moves forward here. Because, you know, my sense of the whole thing was this is a really – it's not just who you play, it's when you play them. The Cowboys, at least defensively, are coming into shape with health. Washington is not in that space, and this was really bad timing to try to catch them. And – it played out that way in the first half that was really bad. But there were a couple things that happened towards the end of the third quarter and into the fourth quarter that I thought were really interesting. Dallas was going jumbo package, putting a backup center as a fullback. Like, they were just going to run the clock. They thought the game was over. And for all intents and purposes, I felt like it was too. I just didn't know what the final score was going to be. And there were two things that happened that really I thought were kind of emblematic of the fight that this team will put up. And that was Ricky Seals-Jones on a really run-of-the-mill just catch, lowers his head and tries to get extra yardage, and there's a pretty decent collision that occurs.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, like, the Cowboys took exception to this, as if, and I said it to D'Angelo on the air, I go, because he's told me this, they've got this lingo called the brother-in-law plays in the preseason, where the guys, like, you know, they kind of olay each other. They don't hit each other, you know. It's like,
right.
I could hit you here. I'm not going to hit you here because why would I hit you here? And it was the attitude that the Cowboys kind of took, like, what are you doing? Like, why are you still playing? This game is over. And they took exception to it. And then a series later, William Bradley King hasn't played the whole year, forced to play, you know, active because of all the injuries and COVID stuff on the defensive line. He's chasing Dak Prescott. Hits him legally, you know, before he goes out of bounds. And Lyle Collins comes up and starts swinging at him.
Yeah.
And it really, like, it was Dallas thought the game was over, acted like the game was over, assumed that Washington would treat the game like it was over, and they didn't. And, man, if they blew that, it would have been one of the all-time collapses in this rivalry's history.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. I was waiting to laugh in Mike McCarthy's face. I mean, this was the perfect setup. Ha, ha, look at that. But and the other thing, when you talk about Collins being kicked out, they congratulated him on that. And I thought Zeke should have been thrown out of the game, too, because he's on the sidelines. He's throwing punches.
You know, this is now second time in 3 weeks. So if you're thinking about, like, are the Cowboys, do they have the medal of a championship team? Because I think they have the roster of a championship team, but I don't know that they have the medal of it.
Yeah.
This second time in 3 weeks, on Thanksgiving, they got into a big fight with the Raiders on a punt return, and people had to be tossed out. You know, if I'm Mike McCarthy today, I'm sure that they're painting this as a dominant first half, and they just held on, and they won, and it's all good, and I told you we were going to win and all that stuff. They nearly blew this game yesterday. Absolutely blew it. They lost their composure again. And I'm now very excited to see this thing in 2 weeks because I really appreciate this thing. Washington was up against it in a way they haven't really been up against it in a while. And they kept fighting, you know, more than anything. They just kept fighting and they were in it. And they're on their third quarterback and fourth center and fourth kicker and 18th defensive lineman or whatever they're on now. And they wouldn't lay down for these guys, and I appreciated it.
Well, and a lot of it was, because this has been their formula during the four-game win streak, is the ability to run the ball, and they're coming up with third and short all the time. Yep. And as Barry Verluga pointed out in his column today, these were the third down situations in the first half, third and 13, 10, 7, 8, 6, and 15. They went 0 for 6. So once you stop the run, then you got to go to the pass. And Terry McLaurin didn't have a catch yesterday. Curtis Samuel didn't have a catch. Trayvon Diggs, man, he's not Deion, but he looks awfully good right now. Yeah. So you shut those two guys down, and you got no running game. You know, what do you got? Plus, you're now down to your fourth string center, and they had other injuries on the offensive line. Really, what are you going to do?
Yeah. During the win streak, I think really this whole being able to get good yardage, solid yardage on first and second down, and setting up all these third and shorts was a big, big, big part of it. And so I, kind of came feeling like, I kind of felt like through the win streak, it wasn't just Heinicke and kind of them battling through the attrition. I wanted to give Scott Turner a lot of credit. We called like Heinicke a game manager, the quarterback a game manager. I thought he was kind of game managing it really well. Like he was putting them in good positions to succeed. They'd have these third and shorts constantly, and good on them for completing them and continuing this. And then basically over the last month, having the best time of possession margin in their favor in the NFL. And it was a big, big, big part of what they're doing, because I know they wanted to be an explosive offense at the beginning of the season, but it has not materialized that way. And they have conformed into what they are now, which is they've got to just move the change. They are a versatile offense when healthy, but they don't have the explosiveness that we thought they'd have. And third and longs are a death sentence for them, especially when they were taking on. And again, this kind of goes back to the timing was really poor. If they had played Dallas 2 weeks ago without DeMarcus Lawrence healthy or Gallimore coming back or Randy Gregory playing, I think it might have been a different situation, but it was just wave after wave. And there was a second thing that happened after Las Vegas. One of my takeaways from the Las Vegas game was I appreciated that they won, and that they were resilient and they owned time of possession and all this stuff. But if you really think back to how their offense performed against the Raiders were fooled by nothing, mm-hmm. the whole game, nothing. So all the misdirection, everything they tried to do, Washington was executing it, but the Raiders were on top of it. And I kind of left thinking, this team has to self-scout and has to tendency break. They've got no choice because people are on them now. What'd they do? They came out completely different. They started throwing. They tried to take a shot to D'Ami Brown. The reality was it didn't work. And then all of a sudden, when they tried to go back to the bread and butter stuff, Dallas was all over them. I really want to give the Cowboys credit in the first half for playing really good defense, more than anything. And it just didn't work. And then all of a sudden, the bad plays turned into disaster plays. The interception to Gregory, mm-hmm. the sack fumble that turned into a touchdown, and now the thing's on tilt. And I think as we've kind of learned here, this is not an explosive team that has the capability like the Chiefs or the Cowboys or the Buccaneers to come back from 24 down, because they just don't have the capability of doing it.
Yeah, I had Trevor Maddich on in the last hour. He had a very good explanation of what happened on the Gregory interception. And he said it was Leno's job to cut him. Gregory stepped back, which enabled him to keep his feet and then jump up and tip the pass. And they showed it on TV that it was there. That was going to be a touchdown if they complete that pass. And if they do, the game takes on a totally different complexion there, I thought.
Yeah, I agree. Watching Dallas coming into it, like they're extremely aggressive, and now they're very healthy, a lot of athletic players up front, which makes them, I think, very dangerous
right.
moving forward if they're going to kind of, round into form there. Their offense is actually a different story. We can talk about that if you want. But defensively, they're kind of rounding into form. But what they do is they're extremely aggressive. They're going to take a lot of chances. They're going to expose their back end. And against Washington, the pressure just got to them. They were overwhelmed. And again, it's one thing to take a sack. Another thing, to have to punt a bunch of times, not get a lot of yardage. But when a defensive lineman's returning the ball for a touchdown, or you're blowing an opportunity on their side of the 50 by throwing an interception to a defensive lineman, that's stuff that this team can't overcome. And it's something that Dallas has kind of made their living on this year. Like, they have a lot of gaudy numbers with turnovers, but they're also like 28th in yards this year.
I know.
So they will take chances. They'll give up yards, but they're like an NBA team. They know there's going to be a Lob City moment for them because they have those kind of athletes on that side of the ball.
Yeah, no, I mean, the defensive athletes that they have are incredible, and that's when I want to get to Micah Parsons. We're talking to Bram Weinstein, voice of the Washington football team. We're both old enough to remember LT in his prime. The performance he had yesterday was vintage LT. He's a rookie. They're going to have to deal with him for a long time. Our friend Doc Walker was converted into a pass-catching tight end, into a blocker called an H-back. They got to make some kind of an adjustment for him, not just for 2 weeks from now, but for like the next 10 years, it looks like.
Yeah, it looks like it. He's Let's see. Coming in, he had played 45% of his snaps in the middle and 45% on the edge, so he's already versatile. They can line him up anywhere. He had sacks from both up the middle and on the edge on this team, had a game-changing play with his sack fumble that he caused. It is very possible that he's going to be the first rookie since LT to win Defensive Player of the Year, let alone Defensive Rookie of the Year, which is a given that he's going to get that. And I agree with you. This is a problem. And, you know, unlike Chase Young, who does have Montez Sweat with him, he's got other athletes with him, you know, like game-changing type of players like Lawrence and Gregory when he's available and reliable to them. And Diggs, who apparently is a very, is turned into a very, very good, you know, ball-hawking cornerback for them. So he's got a lot of advantages right now, but he's really good. He is really good, and you got to account for him. And then sometimes, and I think this is probably what some people were thinking about Chase Young last year, there's just only so much you're going to be able to do. He's just that kind of athlete. I think this is one of those people we're going to have to figure out how to deal with.
Yeah, he lines up everywhere. He's a hybrid, whereas Chase Young is pretty much a standard defensive end. This guy is everywhere. He's a linebacker. He's a defensive end. He's a safety. He plays all over the field.
He's got, what is it, 12 sacks now, 11 sacks now.
Yeah.
8.5 of them have come in the last 6-7 games, so he has really ramped up big time. You know, this is, I really don't know what to say about him other than over the last 4, 5, 6 weeks, he has been the best defensive player in the league.
No question. We're talking to Bram Weinstein. Let me get to the quarterback. Heineke starts next week, according to Ron Rivera, if he's healthy. He told reporters after the game, he didn't do a news conference, but on the phone, he said his knee is okay. But he mentioned something about his elbow. And I just wonder, with what we saw from Kyle Allen, if the leash might be a little bit short on Heineke, especially in the situation they're in now, where each game could pretty much be an elimination game for the playoffs. Would Ron Rivera hesitate to go to Kyle Allen if you get another first half out of Heineke like we saw yesterday?
I would have to see what they do in practice. I mean, like, you have to really remember here, even going back to the summer, because Allen was actually still hurt, and really the competition was between Fitzpatrick and Heineke anyway. I don't think I've seen Kyle Allen take a snap with the first team since last year.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's really, really, really behind with all of that. You know, granted, he's been here, you know, for a year and a half and been with Ron Rivera and Scott Turner for more than that. So there's that benefit. But I don't know that you can sight unseen feel pretty good about it when you have to win. So I don't think that Heineke lost his job yesterday. Although, you know, after the first injury to his elbow when he came back out and then the pressure, this is the first time I think I've seen it. He's gotten away with some this year, but man, he could have had 4 or 5 interceptions yesterday.
I know, yeah.
He threw one pass where there were 5 Cowboys standing around one receiver. A play after, he threw into triple coverage. So at the play to McLaurin, there was a wide-open player there. He's sitting there pointing to McLaurin to just run deep. It turned into backyard football. Same thing happened with the Cam Sims play that turned into a touchdown.
Yeah.
I mean, I think his instincts kind of just took over, you know, because the game had gotten out of hand and the pressure was really overwhelming the Washington offensive line, and this thing turned into a backyard football game. And I think that's what they do not want from him. One, because he can get hurt, which he did twice yesterday, and two, that's not a professional offense. That's what they're trying to do here. So this was the first time that I think we saw kind of the worst instincts of Heineke kind of come out of him. But I don't think he's done anything that really has lost his job. And I really, this goes back to, like, same thing with, like, what people will say about Antonio Gibson. Yeah, he's got to stop fumbling. Like, of course he has to stop fumbling. Where exactly are they turning to, though?
Right, James Williams.
The backup running back yesterday had been on the practice squad for a week, has played a limited amount of games, doesn't even really know the offense. Like, Antonio Gibson has to play and has to perform for them because they need him to. They're running out of people. And I feel the same way about Heineke here. He has to play better, and he has to play because they've kind of leaned in and gone all in on him ever since the Fitzpatrick injury.
Yeah, I agree. I think that they do have to stick with him. But, you know, this team has been getting by on all these backup guys. You know, your backups were on the COVID list yesterday, Tuhill and James Smith Williams. So you know, why not play everybody and just, you know, and all out just to see what they can do? But, you know, it's a crazy league this year, and it's 6-7. They're right there. Everything is right there for them at this point. you know?
Yeah. I mean, they've got two games against the Eagles. If they were to sweep that, and I think that's a big ask because I think we know the rhythms of the sport. When you play teams like this back-to-back, like, it's split almost 90% of the time.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to be hard. But, like, if they do pull this one off and they get them at home, then, you know, they win those two games regardless of what happens in Dallas. They're going to have a really, really, really good shot to end up in the playoffs anyway. And I think that's really – that's a good ending for them if they get there. It does make this game enormous. Obviously, whoever wins this one has got a beeline towards the wild card, and the other one's in big trouble.
Yeah. All right. We'll see. Bram, this afternoon from 3 to 6. Always good to talk to you. Talk to you next week.
All right. See ya.
See ya. That's Bram Weinstein, voice of the Washington football team, with a lot to pick through yesterday. Very bizarre game. A game that was over in the first half and then wasn't over in the fourth quarter. And injuries... Boy, oh boy, you know, keep your fingers crossed on Terry McLaurin. I think that's a huge one to watch for next week, and what they're going to do on the offensive line with yet another one going down yesterday with Tyler Larson likely gone for the year with an Achilles injury. All kinds of things to sort out this week, but again, it's another big Washington week. We got meaningful football in December, and if they beat the Eagles, we're singing a different tune come Monday morning, so... we'll see. Coming up, it's the 93rd anniversary of something you may or may not have worn at some point. I'll explain as we continue. It's the Andy Pollin Hour, ESPN 630. Tony's coming up at 11 o'clock today. Happy 93rd anniversary to the clip-on tie. The clip-on tie was invented December 13th, 1928. I wore clip-on ties. Truth be told, I wore a clip-on bow tie to my daughter's wedding. Well, I think bow ties, I think you get an exemption on bow ties. But clip-on tie at this point, no, I don't think that happens, mainly because you don't really have to wear a tie anymore. Most people don't wear them for work. It's now acceptable not to wear a tie at a wedding. You should wear a jacket, but you don't necessarily have to win a tie, but wear a tie. But I said win a tie. Wear a tie. But in my day, kids who went to parochial schools had to wear a tie, and often they were clip-on ties, and they looked foolish. Let me ask Lauren, if her husband were to put on a clip-on tie for an event, how would you feel?
We wouldn't leave the house.
Yeah, can't let him out of the house
no,
with a clip-on
no
tie.
No, clip-on tie.
Yeah. I don't even know if they sell them anymore. It says here that you can buy them in thrift shops for about $5. But it, you know, to me, it's a rite of passage. My dad taught me how to tie a tie when I was like 12 or 13.
Yeah.
And I taught my son how to tie a tie.
Yeah, it's funny. I used to tie all the basketball players in high school because they wore a jacket and tie to school.
Oh, yeah?
On the days of games.
And they couldn't do it themselves?
They would come to my homeroom and I would tie all of their ties. And it's funny, I went to go tie my husband's tie for a wedding the other day. Could not remember how to do it. I was like,
wait a minute, he can't tie his own tie?
No, he can, but it was like crooked, and I was like, let me fix it.
Oh.
And then I went to go fix it for him, and I was like, I don't know. I guess I've forgotten. I don't know. Need to watch a YouTube video on it.
Who taught you?
YouTube.
Oh, why did you find it important to learn how to tie one?
Well, because my boyfriend in high school at the time was a basketball player,
mm-hmm.
and so he was like, you know, can you... It was, you know, the cutesy thing back in the day. Your boyfriend come to your homeroom so you can tie the tie for him. So it was more of like, we wanted to be that couple, you know?
He and could tie a tie. He just wanted you to do it.
He wanted me to do it.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
I was going to say, if he didn't know how to tie his own tie, I don't know if he's good boyfriend material.
No, he did. But he, you know, it was just the cute thing to do. And then every guy wanted their tie tied.
Uh-huh.
So they would come to me. And I'm like, oh, my gosh.
Lauren's the tie expert.
The tie
Go see
expert.
Lauren.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Not so much anymore.
Right.
In high school, I was.
Well, if you see a clip-on tie, which I probably haven't worn since I was about 8 years old, you know that on this day in 1928, it was invented. A couple of television exits. One, this came out yesterday, Chris Wallace, who I don't know, but I've met a couple of times and has been very, very nice to me. He honored me, said he listened to me, which is really cool. He is leaving Fox and is going to CNN Plus. I don't know exactly what that is, but it's connected to CNN. It's like... I don't want to say it's like joining the other team, but it's kind of like joining the other team because, you know, Fox News and CNN, quite different. He went there 18 years ago. He said they promised him they wouldn't interfere with guest booking or questions, and he said they kept that promise. He said he was very happy with his run there. He says, I've been free to report to the best of my ability to cover the stories I think are important to hold our country's leaders to account. It's been a great ride. We've covered 5 presidential elections, interviewed every president since George H.W. Bush, traveled the world, sitting down with France's Emmanuel Macron, Russia's Vladimir Putin, and I've gotten to spend Sunday mornings with you. It may sound corny, but I feel we've built a community here. 74 years old. Kind of old to be taking another job, but he's going to do that. His father, I think his father worked close to 90 at 60 Minutes. As a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, the last feature that Mike Wallace did for 60 Minutes was a real puff piece on Roger Clemens. It was, you know, most people were going, it doesn't look kosher there. And he kind of did a puffy piece because he had season tickets to the Yankees and he would sit in George Steinbrenner's box and it got a little chummy. And, you know, I don't know if that was what caused him to finally leave 60 Minutes. He was getting older, but that's when he left. And Chris Wallace has had an incredible career himself as a journalist, and to think at 74, it's going to continue. The other exit is Wendy Rieger, and I would bet that Tony will be talking about it today and maybe even today, but sometime this week I would think he would have her on as a guest. She's been on his show many times. I know Wendy a little bit and have always admired her work. She's been a tremendous anchor on Channel 4 for 33 years, a reporter and an anchor. She started off in radio. I think she started off at 6:30, right out of college. She's a couple of years ahead of me at American University. And I think right out of college, she started working for WMAL, worked at WTOP, and then went to Channel 4 33 years ago. She's just gotten married, and she says it's time. It's not something that is related to health issues that she's had recently. She's just fine there. That when she negotiated her last contract, it included an exit now, and Friday will be her last day. And what a wonderful career she's had in television, and she just says time to do something else. So best of luck, Wendy Rieger. She has done a tremendous job over the years. Cream cheese. We got problems with cream cheese. There's a shortage of it. And I've noticed this to some degree. I do the shopping at 6 a.m. on Sunday mornings. I still wake up early. And, you know, those are the senior citizen hours, I guess, at the grocery stores. And so I do the shopping then. And I've noticed you can still get cream cheese, but you have to buy the boxes, you know, the packets, which get kind of, you know, mushed up with the tinfoil and all that. I like the tubs of the cream cheese. I can't find it there at the store that I go to, the Giant. And according to reports now, it's created such a shortage that Junior's, which is famous for cheesecake in New York, had to shut down the cheesecake baking factory for about a week. It shut down on Friday, December the 3rd. Alan Rosen, who is the chairman of Junior, said, we've been scraping by. He said, been getting cream cheese in sporadic supply and praying that the famine ends soon. And he said, December is their big month, busiest month of the year. And he says that since they started making cheesecake at Junior's in 1950, the recipe has stayed the same, 85% cream cheese. That's a lot of cream cheese. And it's also affected the bagel industry. All the bagel shops are scrambling around. Joseph Yema, who's the owner of the Brooklyn-based dairy product distributor F&H Dairies, told the New York Times, I've never been out of cream cheese for 30 years. There's no end in sight. They've had to drive to New Jersey to personally acquire 2,000 pounds of cream cheese just to keep the bagels satisfactorily smeared. Schmeared, that's a good term. So there's a problem. We got to get the cream cheese famine fixed. Not famine, but distribution is more the problem. They just can't get the cream cheese out, and they have to find a way to distribute it a little bit better. This was a column from Pat Forty, who's also a frequent guest with Tony, and it's about the incredible hypocrisy of the NCAA and what a ridiculous joke it's become. Case in point, the Auburn basketball team. Now, they were hit with the highest level of violation a level one aggravated designation for its part in the bribery scandal 4 years ago. Remember the bribery scandal? When this thing broke, I thought, this is going to blow the lid off of college sports. This is before name, image, and likeness came along. It's been nothing. It's been what we call a popcorn fart. I mean, there's nothing here. Nothing has happened here. There was a commission headed up by Condoleezza Rice, the former Secretary of State. They produced a report, and they said, oh, you know, look at what's going on, that Chuck Person, who was an assistant coach at Auburn, took in $91,000 in bribes in return for connecting players with an agent. There was all kinds of hanky-panky going on, and they self-punished themselves, Auburn, last year, when they had a team that stunk, and they said, we're not going to participate in postseason play. This is what Forty says. He says, the Tigers returned zero starters and none of their top six scorers from the previous season. Their leading returning scorer averaged 4.2 points a game. They were picked to finish eighth in the SEC, and their top recruit guard, Sharif Cooper, was ineligible as part of the investigation. And so, no surprise, they finished the year 13-14, 7-11 in the SEC. The school kept a team home that was going nowhere and got significant credit for it, because that's why they said when they gave Bruce Pearl, the coach of the team, a two-game suspension for assistant coaches taking unbelievable bribes and all the other hanky-panky that went on. As 40 points out, the Committee on Infractions bought what Auburn was selling like someone falling for an email scam asking for bank account numbers. They said, oh, we self-punished ourselves. We're not going to be in postseason play. We weren't going to be in postseason play anyway. And by the way, they announced that punishment 2 days or 4 days before the first game of the season, November 22nd, 2020. You don't think he knew that they were going to have a team that wasn't going to make it? And this is Bruce Pearl, who's got a long history of stuff going back to when he was a snitch, back when he was an assistant coach at Illinois in 1989. He was named in violation when he was at Milwaukee in 2004 for inviting a prospect to his daughter's graduation party. Named in violation at Tennessee for inviting a prospect to a backyard cookout in 2008 and then lying about it, and now being part of this wheeling and dealing that was going on with Chuck Person. And yet, it's a two-game suspension. And you wonder why people consider the NCAA to be a joke. Well, it's a bigger joke than it's ever been. And that's an example of that. That, you know, Bruce Pearl, who's got a long history of mishigas and gets caught again and goes to the extent of a self-punishment for what was a joke because they weren't going to be in the tournament anyway, gets credit for that in a two-game suspension. Come on. Nice win by Maryland, though, yesterday. Danny Manning gets his first win. They played Florida. They were trying to give the game away. They had like a couple of 7-point leads late in the game, and they allowed Florida to hit some open threes, and they made it close. But in the end, they pulled it out, and so they now got a long break before they play again on the 28th. And Danny Manning has a win, and they break a 3-game losing streak. So that was good. Good for them. Lauren Durnham, thank you for running the show. Thanks to Trevor Maddich for coming on as he does every Monday. Bram Weinstein as well. You'll hear Bram this afternoon. Tony's coming up next, ESPN 630.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draft access to register for free entry today.